Blog Talk Radio.
Facebook thing, I got this.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a book, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge for a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when I am on the air.
Morning, everyone. This is MJ Network, and I'm your host, Fran Lewis, and this is a very different kind of show. This morning, we're going to be talking about something that needs to be addressed. The opioid crisis has received much attention in the United States. More people than ever are dying from opioid overdose. In 2016, more than 42,000 people were killed by opioids. Across 52 areas in 45 states, opioid overdoses increased by 30% from July 2016 through September 2017. On October 2017, President Trump declared the opioid crisis a public health emergency and pledged resources to address it. The opiates that, for some reason, the first line of defense is oxycodone, Vicodin, morphine, and many others. And today we have the experts here. Then we're going to talk about it with John Land, Dennis Palumbo, Michael Embry, and Reese Hirsch. And good morning, everybody. I think someone just called in. Dennis, is that you?
That's me. Good morning, friend.
Good morning.
Good morning. This is a serious topic because it really bothers me. One of the medical providers I spoke to yesterday said that the first thing they did when he had his surgery was give him a whole bunch of opiates and sedatives, and he said to me, he says, never again. So there's much news about this. John, you wrote Capital Weight, and you did a lot of research. Why did you decide to hit on opiate addiction? And then I have a question for Dennis and then for Reese.
Well, for me, when you write thrillers, you try to hold a mirror up to the to society, and you know, you try to see what's in the headlines, what's relevant, what are people talking about, and you take something that's already a problem and you add even more. You add a conspiratorial element. You take it to an extreme. So I took, as I often do, the old, and you know, this is the cliche rip from the headlines, where you take, you know, I took a problem with Capital White. Now, in that book, it was unique because I was writing with Joe Pistone, an ex-FBI agent who, of course, was Donnie Brasco. And so I had I had this comfort zone where I had an expert in how drugs are dealt, in how the underworld and how crime is involved. And what in Joe's mind was happening, and he's the expert, was that basically what we have here is a different kind of crime family. That's what this is. That's what the pharmaceutical industry, between the manufacturers and the distributors, basically became our cartel. Basically, they became the same thing or the equivalent of the kind of crime family that Joe Pistone and his undercover guys as Donnie Brasco brought down in the 80s. And here it is again. It's just they wear different color suits. And they pretend to be more civilized.
It's scary. So, Dennis, you come in contact with patients every single day. And how do you deal with them with pressures and anxiety? How do you teach them to deal with their pain without prescribing? I mean, the first line of defense I know is when you have an operation is opiates. How do you deal with people that are anxiety-ridden? What do you do for them in order to not give them this type of medication? Or is that not preventable?
That's a fairly broad question, Fran, particularly because there's no one-size-fits-all kind of answer. When I think of addiction in general, I always think of what Jung said, which is that he thought any kind of substance addiction was a spiritual mm-hmm. issue. And by that, he didn't mean spiritual like God up in the sky, but a sense of meaning. I think if you look at our culture in general, there's a kind of socio-political aspect to this. Not only, I love what John said about the cartel, because one of my issues is when I read about some drug executive whose salary is $62 million a year, and they're upping the prices of medication for people. That mm-hmm. kind of stuff makes me crazy, as you can imagine. But it is the new cartel, and that cartel includes doctors who overprescribe. Mm-hmm. But the reality is we live in a culture where if you are depressed or anxious, even if the situation would make anyone depressed or anxious, the first line of defense is often psychotropic drugs. And my view is that should be the sort of course of last resort. You know, I don't believe people get a gold star in heaven for suffering, but I also think that there is a lot of burdens in life, both physical, financial, and emotional, that everyone has to struggle with. And if you have a sense of meaning, you can sort of integrate emotions around that struggle. If things seem meaningless, if you're, you know, frankly, if you're someone out in a trailer home and you can't get a job and you have two kids and the future looks terrible to you, who can blame them for wanting the release of an mm-hmm. opioid? It's not like, wow, these are bad people or these are weak people or these are morally lax people. These are desperate people. Mm-hmm. And so you have two different types. You have the you know, because we think of substance abuse, we think of ghettos and poverty-stricken rural areas. Actually, that's not where most opioid abuse is. It's in the suburbs and among fairly well-to-do people. I mean, they're the ones getting prescribed Oxycontin and fentanyl and all these other mm-hmm. things. So I guess from a therapist standpoint, I look at the issues going on in the person's life and figure out with them better tools to handle the anxiety and depression and help them understand that sometimes those feelings are an appropriate response to the situation they're in. And so mm-hmm. they don't necessarily have to medicate themselves out of it.
I agree with you 100% because I know that the first line of defense sometimes after a surgery is, would you like Percocet, Oxycodone, Vicodin, Morphine, Tegradol, Tramadol, Oxycarbazepine, Carbazepine, Tramadol. Don't ask me how I know this, but I do know this. And the side effects alone could put you out. And sometimes they give you more than one. And they'll say, well, why don't you take this? And then they look at you like you're crazy if you don't take it. And
if you think about it, as a medical professional, one of their goals is pain relief.
Yeah.
It's very hard to say to a medical professional, here's something that will take away your patient's pain. Don't give it to
you.
So it's not a one-way street. It's contextual. The whole process is contextual. Again, that's why I like so much what John said, is we are operating under certainly a new zeitgeist where the cartels now are big pharmaceuticals, the AMA. I mean, they're all in sort of a conscious or unconscious collusion to keep everybody medicated. It's almost like Aldous Huxley wrote about Soma in Brave New World, which is let's mm-hmm. keep everybody tranquilized.
I agree with you. I mean, there were times I was under the impression, and I don't know, that you could they were trying to limit the number of prescriptions you can have for that particular thing with the number of pills. And yet I know someone that got a prescription for Tramadol and then a week later got another prescription for Tramadol and they filled it. So, Reese, you deal with privacy laws. How does this come into play with opiates and doctors or family members to want this person to get help? You know, how do you deal with that?
Right, right. In addition to the thrillers that I write, I'm a privacy attorney, and I deal with healthcare privacy in particular. And so, yeah, this is sort of a hot-button issue in privacy law right now because traditionally there's been a very stringent federal law called 42 CFR Part 2 that is basically designed to protect the sensitivity of this substance abuse information. But at the same time, there's, you know, a general healthcare privacy law called HIPAA that allows for broader disclosures, reasonable disclosures of medical information. And so there's been a lot of effort to sort of bring those two together because often there are emergency situations with opioid overdoses, and there are concerns that HIPAA or this other law, you know, would prohibit physicians from sharing that information with family members and others who might be able to help deal with a crisis. And the basic message that the Department of Health and Human Services has been sending is that HIPAA is a flexible enough law to allow for that kind of information sharing, at least in emergency situations. You know, if you have a family member who's incapacitated, comes into an emergency room, you know, suffering from an opioid overdose, you know, there are, you know, exceptions in the rules that will allow those emergency room personnel, you know, to talk with the family member and share information needed to avert, an immediate medical emergency. Of course, later, you know, when the patient is conscious, they may later say, you know, I don't want my information shared with these family members. Get them out of the room. I don't want to, you know, don't want them involved in my care. And, you know, they do have the right to do that later. But but I think it's sort of an area of tension in the law. And in my thrillers, you know, I kind of touched on this subject a little bit, as you know, Fran, because, you know, like John said, it's sort of the new cartel concept. But my thriller, Black Nowhere, was inspired by the true story of Silk Road and Ross Ulbricht, the young man who founded that dark web marketplace, because, you know, there you're able to get, you know, opioids and other illicit drugs through the dark web. And in a way, that's also a version of the new cartel. And in my book, the old cartel doesn't appreciate the new cartel and tries to shut it down.
Well, what would happen if somebody, actually, like you brought it up, but everybody brought it up, this person that's in a coma, whatever, they're not awake, and they give them these opiates, and they don't know if they're allergic to anything specific in them, and then they wake up and go like, oh my God, I would never agree to that. How does that work with the privacy law or sharing or the HIPAA law? What if they said, I would never take a painkiller, but you gave it to me because my family said that she's in pain, or maybe they don't like the family member?
Yeah, well, that might be a little bit more in Dennis's ballpark because it's not so much a privacy issue there as an issue of informed consent and whether it's appropriate to treat a patient in that situation with that kind of medication.
Yeah, in that case, you would need informed consent. Hopefully, a family member has been given the legally to speak on your behalf, but that's not always the case. And despite the Hippocratic Oath of first do no harm, the instinct of medical personnel is to provide pain relief. And but I actually don't know I'm not a lawyer, I'm a psychologist, so I don't know the legal ramifications. But I do know, you know, the interesting thing, you know, we're all talking about the books that we write. And Fran, as you know, the protagonist of my series of novels, Daniel Rinaldi, is a trauma expert. So he works with the victims of crime. And traumatized people who primarily suffer from, like, PTSD, it's very, very common to deal with their trauma symptoms with medication. And, again, it's often the first line of defense.
Yeah.
And it's important whether your trauma is small, you didn't get into the school you wanted to get into, or big, you've been kidnapped. The important thing is, to pay attention to the meaning you give it. If you're someone to whom a crime has happened, and this is very common, by the way, if you're someone a crime has happened, let's say you've been mugged or carjacked or whatever, if you go into a state of saying, I shouldn't have been driving down that road or I wouldn't have been carjacked, I shouldn't have been walking down that street or I wouldn't have been mugged, you end up blaming yourself. Often patients end up taking medication to quiet those voices. And that's the work that the therapist needs to do, not psychotropic drugs. One of the things that makes trauma so powerful for people is the meaning they give to it and the tendency to blame themselves for the situation they find themselves in. And, you know, self-blame is so painful that, you know, if you take, you know, morphine and everything in the world seems fine, your self-blame is going to go away. And so then to say to someone, well, don't do that. Just walk around feeling terrible about yourself.
Oh, God.
That's not going to work. So, again, it's important not to blame the victims here. I think it's not just a cartel of pharmaceuticals and doctors. It's also the mental health profession that has an idea of what normal states are like. Well, I don't know anybody who's normal. And normal conventional feeling states nowadays seems to imply no self-doubt, no pain, no sadness, no grief, and no yearnings. Well, you're going to have to medicate those away. I think they're part of the human condition and okay. But our view is they're not okay. And these things will stabilize all these feelings. And again, I feel like it's a way to tranquilize people out of their authentic, deep emotional states.
Do you think anybody, that there's one group of people, because I'm looking at this, and I know that young adults sometimes are in college and they need Xanax or Ativan or Haldol or even worse. What's the difference between taking all of these opiates or somebody giving you Valium, diazepam, or Versed or any of those sedatives? What would be the difference? And why are there so many adolescents out there that are can't deal with a lot of things, and I see it every single day. I mean, do you think there's any one group of people, or is it just people in general that when they have a problem, instead of seeking help or yelling or screaming or talking about it, they automatically go, I'm going to have my Xanax, so I'm going to just calm down?
Well, again, I speaking as a therapist, I think that's a broader socioeconomic and cultural issue. In the sense that we now overprescribe because I think we overdiagnose.
Yeah.
I mean, at one point it was ADHD. Now you're not cool if you're not bipolar. And, you know, I remember so often when I was in training as a therapist, you would hear about, oh, some kid, he's overactive, whatever. Then you go into the classroom and you see a bunch of third grade boys running around like monkeys. That's what they're supposed to do. But humans at that age are not supposed to do is sit quietly at their desks for 8 hours and look attentively while the teacher talks about something that doesn't interest them. So I think we have to be very, very careful. In the same way that someone diagnosed with ADHD who doesn't do their homework, if you put them in front of a video game that has very complicated instructions, they'll sit there for 8 hours. And all their executive functions are working fine as they work themselves through the game. So obviously, they can focus. Obviously, they can keep concentration. But it has to interest them to do so. And so I think you start then talking about everything from conventional testing to sociocultural requirements that's, you know, way above my pay grade, to be honest with you. But I think those are the issues that, you know, and I think we do overdiagnose. I mean, there's a label for everything. And it's important to remember that diagnostic labels exist for the convenience of the labelers.
Fran, I think these are all excellent points, but I think what we're identifying here is there's a problem in the micro and there's a problem in the macro. There's a problem with overprescription. There's a problem with how these drugs are being dispensed. You know, and you can remedy that. You can remedy that with a lot of the measures that are being put into place. But in the macro, you have situations like Mingo County, West Virginia, where 25,000 people live. In all this county, 25,000 people. In Mingo County 3 years ago, there were enough opioids distributed for each of those 25,000 people to get 450 pills in one single year. Now, obviously, not everyone is using all those pills, so they're being dumped into the market because there's a market for them. How do they sell? It's in the, you take that, apply that to Florida, where until very recently you had more of what they call pill mills, one-stop clinics, where pretty much anybody can walk in, be falsely diagnosed with something they don't have, pick up, not only get a prescription, but have it filled on the spot. These, there were more pill mills in Florida 4 years ago than there were McDonald's. That's not an exaggeration. And in many cases, there were pill mills next to McDonald's, mostly located in strip malls. And when the authorities close one down, it opens up across the street again because it's legal. It is totally legal to do this. You're not just talking about a patient, a single patient in pain being overprescribed and becoming an addict. You're talking about people who use oxy or fentanyl as a substitute for heroin. And what happens is, this is the reason why heroin has become, the popularity of heroin, if that's the right word, has exploded. Because once you can't get opioids anymore or you can't afford them, you turn to a cheaper alternative. In this case, that's heroin. This is, and the same thing is true of fentanyl. Last year, 72,000 people died of overdoses, of opioid overdoses. 72,000. That's a national epidemic. If we had 72,000 people, and when you think about gun violence, kills half of that. That's it, half of that. All of Vietnam did not kill 72,000 people. And yet that's what we're going to lose, and it's going up every year. It's going up 15 to 20% every single year because in the macro, these drugs are so readily available and easily obtainable on a mass level. Now, the government is doing things to restrict this kind of distribution now, at least they supposedly are. But there's also, and this is what I don't understand, when you look at the government, you would think that Washington would want to do something about this. Mm-hmm. But Washington is in the pockets of Big Pharma. Too many people are being lobbied and basically bought off. Give you an example. Tom Marino, who was, you know, Trump's choice for, I forgot what it was, National Health Czar, something like that. But anyway, Tom Marino, who's a doctor and a representative from Pennsylvania, wrote a bill which basically emasculated the DEA. And this thing was about to pass or did pass until a few Democrats realized what the Republicans had basically forced through, which was a drug that literally made it impossible for the DEA to enforce its own rules. And who hires ex-DEA lawyers at the highest level available? Drug manufacturers and drug distributors, because that teaches them how to game the system. They know how to beat the system because they hire the people who created the system.
This is scary. I mean, I taught for 36 years, and I know there are kids out there that were able to get oxycodone and heroin and all whatever and pills and selling them for money. I mean, how do you stop that? There's high schools, people are outside. I mean, I see it. People are outside selling. There are kids that are vaping, however you want to pronounce it. That's just as dangerous as this. How do you stop that? I mean, there are drug dealers that approach kids, they're teenagers, and you want to make some extra money. Not that they're going to take it, but, you know, want to sell some oxy on the street. How do you stop that? Because, I saw it by my school.
I think that a lot of the problem starts with, like as John said, the pharmaceutical companies, because you know, those who had patents for some of these drugs over-marketed them and incentivized physicians to over-prescribe and basically created the market that's now playing out in the black market And you know, it's hard to put that genie back in the bottle once you have a large population that's addicted to these substances.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, one trend is lawsuits brought against some of these mm-hmm. pharmaceutical
yes.
companies, you know, to hold them accountable. And you know, that's, you know, that's a step in the right direction, but it's a little late to actually cure the problem.
I went into the pharmacy a while ago, and I had surgery on my, you know, I had a root canal, whatever, and the doctor prescribed something, and the pharmacist said, you're not getting that. You know, you wouldn't take it anyway. And I thought that was fantastic. I don't know how many pharmacists would do that. They prescribe Percocet for a root canal, and I said, I'll take Tylenol or Motrin. I won't take anything. How many pharmacists would do that? Or they just fill the prescription and say, you know, oh, this is your copay. And they went and specifically said, you're not going to fill that, are you? I go, no, definitely not. I mean, how many would do that, seriously? And do they turn down? Can pharmacies actually turn down recurring prescriptions for patients that are constantly getting prescriptions every couple of weeks for the same thing? Or is it just because they want their money?
Well, there are, you know, networks, you know, that pharmacies participate in to, you know, to identify patients who are coming back for, you know,
yeah.
pseudoephedrine and other, you know, prescription drugs that are subject to abuse. So there are ways that they try to check that, but then there are always ways to attempt to get around that too.
Well, pseudoephedrine is bad if you have a thyroid problem. You don't want to take that, trust me. I wonder how many times they actually tell the patient the side effects. Or the patients, I know that even if I get an antibiotic, I read everything. And then if I don't like it, I won't take it. I mean, seriously, how many people know what oxycarbazepine or carbazepine and Neurontin and Tramadol, how many actually know what these drugs do? Do they actually, they're supposed to tell you, right? The pharmacists are supposed, but they're busy sometimes. So what do you do? You take this home and then all of a sudden you feel like you're in another world. How do you stop that? How do you insist that they talk to you, even if they don't?
Well, again, it's, how responsible do you want to be for your own self-care? Again,
yeah.
You know, I my response to that kind of question is that of a therapist. In other words, I look at, okay, you're a patient of a doctor and he or she prescribes something for you. In that moment, your transference on that doctor is parental. This is an authority figure who knows what's best for me. When people are in, they're regressed. I mean, I know, God knows, if I get a cold, all of a sudden I'm 6 years old and I want everyone to bring me chicken soup. And so it's very often the case that people who've been traumatized, who are in pain, who've had a terrifying surgery or a frightening surgery, they're quite regressed. And they'll do whatever mommy or daddy tells them to do to make them feel better. Because in that regressed state, anyone in authority becomes mommy or daddy. Again, this is extraordinarily simplistic, and it's a big generalization. But the end result is often people don't research the side effects of the medication.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even read what's on the side of the bottle.
That's
they
bad.
Just want it because they were told this would make them feel better. And so there is a psychological component to the way in which people respond to the treatment that their medical providers suggest to them.
Yeah, I know, because they automatically say, well, the doctor said it, it's got to be so. Trust me, the doctor said it, so what? It doesn't mean it has to be so. I have my own reasons for doubting everything that they say, and I question everything. And the other thing I'm finding that I ask a lot of questions. And that's why all of your characters are so fantastic, because I'm the same way. I'm not going to stop until I get the answers that make sense to me. And if I'm not sure, I'm going to keep going until I get them. Why don't people ask these questions? In other words, the doctor says it, the pharmacy says, okay, I'm going to fill this, and they get annoyed with you if you ask questions. I mean, seriously.
Well, that's one of the reasons.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They don't want to answer your question. How come?
Well, because they may have to deal with the reality that you may not like their answer. And so also, if a person is raised, for example, and again, I my answers are always coming from the perspective of a therapist, but if you're raised in a where you don't question authority or you don't ask questions about why we're doing X, Y, or Z, it's very unlikely as an adult you're going to question a pharmacist or a doctor. You're going to assume they know and you don't. And they're giving you the promise of alleviation of pain, which is, you know, pain is, you know, Stanislavski, the acting teacher, once said, a man with a toothache cannot be in love, meaning that if you have some kind of pain like that, you'll do anything to alleviate it, and nothing else will divert you from that, which is why so many people...
I agree with you.
They seek prescriptions because they want pain relief, and the reality is there's a lot of pain in life. That's always the point I keep trying to make to people. It's not like your life wrong if you're in pain emotionally. Life is difficult.
I know. I mean, they make you feel as if you're not smart. Oh, how could you not listen to me? What do you know? I'm the doctor. That doesn't mean my first question is, do I really need this? Why are you giving it to me? I mean, even if you need an antibiotic, is that the first line of defense? Can I take Motrin or Tylenol? Do I really need this? And if I'm taking it, how many days do I have to take it? Why do I have to take it? I think more people need to do that. And they're just, for some reason, they're afraid to say anything. So how do we prevent opiate misuse? What about education in high school, in junior high school, or family members learning more about it, or somebody that comes in and says, I need Xanax or I need all this stuff? How do you educate them, parents or kids or anything, not to use this stuff? What do you do to prevent this from happening, opiate misuse? Or can't we do that? Or doesn't it work?
Well, to be honest with you, I think there's a reason for cautious optimism, because I think about smoking.
Mm-hmm.
If you would have told 40 years ago that enough campaigns about the problems and the medical issues associated with smoking would reduce smoking as much as it has, cigarette smoking, I would have said you were crazy. And so it is possible if the government, if nonprofits, if the medical community, the pharmaceutical community, and the mental health community got together and created a massive public awareness campaign, I think we could turn the tide a little bit. It's like what people are trying to do now about vaping. You know, because the marketplace is, there will always be people who organize themselves to make money off of marketing something that is bad for people and making a lot of money from it. That's the American way, you know. That's what makes borderline criminal in my mind. And so as a result,
I agree with you.
We have to create the awareness. And like I said, it happened with cigarette smoking. A lot less people smoke cigarettes than used to.
I don't understand why they spend $10 or $12 for one pack of cigarettes or a carton for a lot more. And I'm glad you brought up vaping, because there was a vaping place right down the block from us, and they closed. And now they moved somewhere else. And where did they move? Right across the street from the high school in Yonkers. Right there. And who's going to go there? The kids. You could see them outside, and they don't realize how many kids have died from vaping. That's serious, too. And then the menthol and the nicotine, it's the same stuff as in them as in theirs, maybe not as much. And then the ones that have scents or flavors or something, what makes them think it's any better? The other thing is... a lot of times, what do you think about medical marijuana for pain? How safe is that? That's a question I've been asked before.
I think medical marijuana, I mean, you talk to people who are chemotherapy patients. You talk to people who have Parkinson's. You talk to people who are getting incredible relief with medical marijuana. Every study that's been done on marijuana is that it's less addicting than caffeine. So I think that to even bundle medical marijuana and opioids,
you can't.
I don't think you can, because opioids. The old saying in opioids is if you're swallowing it as a pill, it's a problem. When you're snorting it, it's a crisis, because the bulk of illicit opioids are snorted like cocaine. That's how you get the immediate rush. These are the people who are abusing opioids are abusing them for the same reason they may abuse, you know, another kind of drug. You could abuse marijuana. You can abuse alcohol. Obviously, the problems we have in this country with alcohol are monumental. Drunk driving kills, what is it, you know, kills around 30,000 people a year. So I think that when you start looking at ranking these things, and you come up against that 72,000 overdose figure, and you come up against how this entire network, and I love the allusion to the dark web before, because there is so much in common with the underworld, the modern day underworld, compared to the old way crime was done, and the internet. Without knowing this for a fact, I would bet you could buy opioids on the dark web. Of course, you have no idea where they came from. You have no idea who manufactured them. And that's the other problem. You have counterfeit pills that are entering the market from China. These pills are dangerous. They have poisons in them, because when you're going to a pill mill and you're an addict, and you're addicted to Oxy, or you're addicted to heroin, you're using Oxy, you have no idea. There's no safeguards in place at a pill mill. You're basically buying something that could kill you. You have no idea where it came from. I think there was testing done on some of those pills. I don't remember this for a fact, but they found either arsenic or strychnine or something in these pills. Because you can regulate the above board stuff. You can regulate and enforce new laws and quotas and limit the number of pills a legitimate person fills in a prescription. But the problem isn't the legitimate prescriptions that are being filled. The problem, to a much greater extent, are people who are buying these drugs without a legitimate prescription. You have 10 people who go into one of these pill mills. They're not even getting the drugs for themselves. They're getting the drugs for a dealer who's going to take the 50 pills each of them fills. The dealer is going to pay them $5 a pill. Then they're going to go to another pill mill and do exactly the same thing. Often they travel around literally in a van and go to all these different places to fill these prescriptions, which then are given to street dealers who move the drugs on the street for $25 to $50 a pill, depending on the strength. It's all based on the strength. There's a super Oxy out there now, which is really dangerous. Because what happens is you develop a tolerance for these drugs. So you need more and more of them to achieve the same effect. And where do you go to get the money? It creates crime. It creates incredible amounts of money lost in wages and in treatment. It's truly a national crisis. We're losing the war on drugs.
I would think so.
We are losing the war on drugs. I've actually done another book, a nonfiction book called Chasing the Dragon, about the number one of the most celebrated DEA agents of all time, who ran the DEA's offices in South America during the French Connection years, and then he was over in the Golden Triangle during the Vietnam years. So he saw firsthand what it's like when you have a cooperative government, when you have literally the criminals and the drug dealers are being shielded. We talk about Afghanistan. We're making Afghanistan safe for the poppy growers. There is more heroin coming out of Afghanistan now than at any other time in history, partially because we have to protect the warlords who are on our side, and the warlords are the biggest drug dealers in the country. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
This is scary. I know. I'm just reading articles. I printed out a whole bunch this morning. Lebanon, Turkey, China. I know that I take one thing. I have acid reflux, so I take Nexium. That's it. And I was just told by my pharmaceutical company they're dropping it. And they said that if I want to take it, I have to take the generic, which I won't. And I have to go through this whole process because they decided to raise the price from $25 to $40 to $268 for 30 pills. How do you combat that? I mean, this is the new year. So now they're saying everything starts all over again, and if you want to do this, you have to go for prior authorization on something that you've been taking for 20 years, and it's on a simple nothing medication. What do you do with that? I mean, that's what people are going to be facing, because you're going to get letters that say, well, we're not going to cover this, and if you want to cover it, you're going to have to pay 10 times the amount that you paid before. And that's benefiting, right, the drug companies. How do you counter out that? I couldn't believe this the other day. I go like, oh, my God. I had to find another one. And then they said, well, you could get it from Turkey or China or Lebanon. You can get it overseas. Not in a million years would I ever do that. What do you do when they drop your medication, or they tell you you can get it anywhere else but you can't get it here? What do you do then?
Yeah, that sort of taps into the bigger problems in our healthcare system about the cost of medications.
Yeah.
But one of the dangerous things that's sort of fueled the opioid crisis is that some of these new drugs like fentanyl are so powerful.
Yeah.
And when you sort of turn them loose and, you know, encourage and incentivize the use of or prescription of drugs like that, you know, it's really a recipe for creating addiction. So part of the problem is a law enforcement problem, and that's something I dealt with in my thriller with my FBI agent character who's trying to shut down one of those dark web marketplaces. You know, that from a law enforcement standpoint, you know, it's incredibly challenging because, you know, you're playing whack-a-mole. You know, as soon as you shut down one dark web website, you know, 10 more pop up around the world, and they, you know, they can be located anywhere. And you know, it also, you know, one of the insidious things about these dark web marketplaces is they make the drugs so accessible because, you know, someone doesn't even have to go out into the street necessarily and risk safety to do a street transaction. They can have these, you know, incredibly powerful substances like fentanyl, you know, delivered right to their doorstep if they have a Tor web browser to access the dark web. And so that's a problem that's, you know, not going to go away anytime soon. But one thing that the government can regulate is, you know, how these substances are prescribed. And maybe, you know, it's possible to curb, you know, the new addicts that are being created by managing these medications a little bit better than they have been.
Do you think that the drug companies actually would prefer that people become addicted? I often wonder about that. I mean, John, you dealt with this in your book. I know that. Maybe, do they actually want people? Would they feel better because, okay, you got oxycodone and Percocet? Yeah, that's great. You're going to be addicted. We're going to make more money. Do you think that they really would want them to be, you know, curbed or restrictions? Or do they actually want people to become addicted to this so they make money?
I think this has become such a cottage industry for at so many levels. So many people are making money on it, starting with, you know, the politicians who are being basically paid off by the lobbyists. To look the other way. But I think there was a great point made before about the lawsuits. Look at Purdue Pharma, which has filed bankruptcy. Look at Johnson. Some of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world have been found negligent and are being forced to pay these huge settlements in the billion-dollar range. So I think if you're going to affect drugs, and those are states, by the way, states like Rhode Island and Massachusetts, two of the smallest states physically in the country, are two that have had some of the most success. Ohio has had incredible success. I think the other problem we have, and I'd love to get everybody's take on this, is that there are too many nonviolent drug offenders in prison that we're not focusing on treatment. So we have a nation of literally millions of addicts. And the problem with opioids is that many of them are functional addicts. The stories we hear every day of ordinary people who live next door, the opioid crisis isn't just an inner city problem where your drug dealer is on the corner. In suburbia, you know, your drug dealer is a mail order company out of Canada or Mexico or something like that. And you're just as likely to find somebody who's addicted to opioids next door as you are, you know, holding up, a tin can and a homeless sign. So it's a new paradigm. And if you know, when you think about it, law enforcement is always a little late to the party when it comes to a new scourge. They were late to the party with cocaine in the late 70s and into the 80s because it was the so-called safe drug. It was years after cocaine became huge, as exemplified so brilliantly on Miami Vice, that law enforcement said, oh, we've got a problem with cocaine. The same thing happened with opioids. The opioid crisis has been going on for years, but it's only been recognized as a crisis in the last few years after so many lives have been ruined, so many lives have been destroyed. But if you can affect the manufacturers and the distributors, because the distributors are as guilty in this as the manufacturers, if not more. But everybody's looking the other way. The manufacturers don't know how many billion pills where those pills ended up. They're just because they put them into the hands of consolidators, these distributors who get them into the pharmacies, but also the pill mills, also the illicit traffic, also into the hands of dealers, because everybody is making so much money at every rung of the ladder until the supply dries up, it's going to continue. And I do think that if there are less opioids being manufactured, obviously there will be less opioids that reach Mingo County, West Virginia, as I mentioned before, or those pill mills that were up and down the entire state of Florida for so many years.
You said something very interesting, though, about order. Can pharmacies over-order an opiate, and do the people in jail, they get them also. They, for some reason, they get infiltrated there. If they're addicted, somehow they get them in jail anyway. The guards bring them or whatever. But can a pharmacy order more Percocet or fentanyl or whatever? Can they order more than they need? Or is there a certain amount that they're allowed to have every month? When they run out, they order more. Can they order like 2,000 more pills or 100 more pills? Or does it matter?
Well, yeah, I think the pharmacies are really driven by the prescriptions, and so I think it's the doctors and the healthcare providers that are driving the demand for the drug, at least on that end. And so I don't think the pharmacies are necessarily responsible for sort of driving purchasing of those drugs so much. You know, I think they just need to have the stocks necessary to fill the prescriptions that they're getting.
Yeah, I think it's primarily part of a larger system, as has been mentioned before, that it's, mental health providers, psychiatrists, or now as we call them, neuropharmacologists. The very fact that we changed the name from psychiatrist to neuropharmacologist reminds us, you go to see a psychiatrist, you're going to get a psychotropic drug. I mean, the psychiatrists I refer people to for medication when they need it don't even do therapy. All they do is prescribe. That's the only thing they're supposed to do. So if you're going to go see a neuropharmacologist, you're going to get a prescription. And if you're in any pain and you see an internist or any physician, you can see your dentist and you're going to get a prescription. What we do now is we have the association of pain with whether it's emotional or physical, as if you're feeling really, depressed because a parent died, well, here, take a med. And see, my argument would be, of course you're depressed. Your parent just died. It's situation appropriate for you to be grieving right now. And see, as long as the culture, and then now you can talk about advertising and TV commercials, as long as the culture keeps presenting an idea of well-being and normalcy as being an aspect of life in which none of these emotional pains are normal, then you're going to want to medicate against it.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah, you're right. When my sister died, I said, gee, how am I going to ever deal with it? And it's been almost 10 years. I think I dealt with it maybe a little bit differently than any. Rather than taking a pill, I created this network in her memory, and I wrote books in her, about her with myself. I don't know how many people other than that. You're right. I need a tranquilizer. I need Valium. I need something because I'm upset because my parents died. That doesn't help anything because they're not going to bring them back. They wouldn't want you to do that. So how do we, before I forget, Tuesday, I have Jill Rosenfeld, the last Romanoff, and on Thursday, I have Lou Aragne, who is the publisher for Storyplant for Birthright. And those are the last two until next year. I'm taking a break. So seriously, is there a viable solution? I mean, schools, there's the National Institute on Drug Abuse for Teachers. I wonder how many of them, you know, realize it. I know that when kids come to high school, they have to be able to see, teachers should be able to see if somebody is on something or doesn't look right. How many of them report that? I know I reported child abuse. How do we stop that in the schools? How do we look at, what do you look for when you're looking to see if somebody is on drugs? How do you know that somebody is there? How do you know if a patient walks in and looks like they're really out of it? What do you do?
Well, it depends on the laws of the school district. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, the number one thing, like I said about smoking, is education.
Yeah.
I mean, we have to not only educate the students and the public, we have to educate the educators, because half the teachers may be people who themselves are using substances, not because they're bad, but because they're overwhelmed. I mean, the thing is, it's ubiquitous. I think we're all trying to say, I think, a version of the same thing. The horse has left the barn. Closing the door now is going to be really, really easy. Got to train the next horse not. That's the only way we can do it. The horses that have left the barn, there's nothing you can do about it by shutting the door. That's why the war on drugs fails, because it doesn't understand that it's all supply and demand. And nothing circumvents supply and demand in a culture that is run on profits. It just, you can't. And so as a result, the only thing you can do is try to educate the next horse not to leave. That's all you can do.
That's scary.
But I think we've learned, you know, that incarceration isn't the answer. You know, addiction treatment is a better route to go down. And, you know, we saw it with the crack epidemic. You know, that led to the three strikes law, which put so many people in jail. And I think now we're kind of revisiting some of that history with the presidential race, the Democratic race, with some of the conversation that went on between Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And I think now we can see the errors of that approach to, you know, to drug enforcement. And I think hopefully, you know, we'll continue to keep those lessons in mind and focus on addiction treatment rather than just locking addicts up.
Yeah,
I have one more question before we end. What part does the DEA play? Do they actually try to stop this, or are they a part of this also, or don't they care?
The DEA cares. I mean, I think they care deeply. It's interesting because the DEA, again, the DEA is a very big ship, and it takes a big ship a long time to turn at sea, up to a mile, right? In the case of the DEA, they have so long been geared toward dealing with narcotics interdiction, which is an entirely different thing, because you're dealing with street drug dealers, you're dealing with illicit drugs coming into the country by airplane through ports. You could have one of the biggest drug shipments ever back in the days of the French Connection was found within literally inside fish that were on ice in a trawler. It was the amount of cocaine or heroin that was pulled out of the fish was absolutely incredible. So that the DEA is great, and they specialize, when they're dealing with the underworld. The problem with opioids is it's not the underworld that's the problem for the most part. We've been talking about it, the distributors and the pharmaceutical mm-hmm. manufacturers who have
yeah.
replaced that. So the DEA, again, is now it becomes, as I mentioned before, these companies hire ex-DEA lawyers to tell them how to beat the system. So they know how to beat the system. And for too long, there was too much money going to politicians to prevent the kind of legislation from being passed, because the pharmaceutical lobby spends 10 times as much on lobbying a year as the gun lobby. 10 times. $770 million last year, I believe, was spent by the pharmaceutical lobby. Where is that $770 million going? Ultimately, it's going into the pockets of politicians. That's where it goes. And the people who are padding their pockets with the money from Big Pharma are going to do everything they can to weaken the laws that would allow Big Pharma to be brought down. This is why these lawsuits are so vital, because these mm-hmm. local lawsuits at the state level, even if it's in federal court, but it's states who are bringing it, they are bypassing the Senate. They are bypassing Congress. They are suing these companies directly and not waiting for laws to be passed. You know, how many – you know, how there'll be a press conference, you know, there'll be a new announcement, and the politicians, we're going to do this, we're going to form a committee, and nothing ever happens. They never do a thing to reduce the amount of drugs reaching the streets that are becoming available to pretty much anybody who wants them and can afford them. And that doesn't address the legitimate issue. That's another issue. This is the illegitimate prescription issue, so which is far, far worse than the overprescription by legitimate doctors to people who are in real pain. Let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. These drugs have a purpose. Some people are only able to function every day because they're taking them. And if you take them away from those people, they're going to lose their quality of life. And that's a small percentage of the amount of distribution that's out there, very small.
Well, that's
I understand,
what makes
Mike. I agree with you. My cousin uses them every single day. I don't know how she walks around. Oxycodone, Vicodin, Percocet, and morphine every single day. I was like,
well, that's the reality, that there are people
I know.
Whose quality of life would not be sustainable without medication. It's sort of like if you're trying to lose weight, you can't not eat because you'll die. Well, there are people for whom medications are vital to the quality of their life, but how do you parse out and the appropriate manufacturing and distribution to people for whom it's absolutely crucial and separate that out the way the epidemic has spread? That's really hard to do, and it takes a cooperation between industry and government that – I don't see happening because of the lobbies.
Well, before we end, I want everybody to tell us where we could find out more about everyone and what's next and when am I getting it, because I've got this huge pile on my chair of 1,000. Yeah, I received David Baldacci's book this morning, and I received 2 David Rosenfeld books and a children's book. When I opened the door, I almost tripped over them. That they were there. I was like, oh my God, what else is going to happen? So, John, when am I getting Caitlin Strong? And by the way, 5 people had their hands out for A Time for Murder. They had a fight for it, literally.
Oh boy. Well, I don't want to close any fights. And by the way, I actually revisit the opioid issue in that new Caitlin Strong book, which is called Strong from the Heart.
Good.
So you're the timing is for this show is perfect, except the book won't be out till July. So I'd say another 8 weeks before I have a galley to send you.
I'm sure they will. And Dennis, when are you writing another Rinaldi book so I can read it?
Well, thank you so much for mentioning it. You can learn about my Daniel Rinaldi series about psychologist Daniel Rinaldi at my website, which is dennispalumbo.com. As for the new Rinaldi, you know, he's a very busy guy. I'll have to call him and see what he's been up to.
Well, Tony's going to be sorry if he doesn't write something very soon, because after all, we don't want anybody to forget who he is, seriously.
Oh, well, I don't want anyone to forget who he is either. There's 5 books in the series, and I've been very in how they've been received. So I have to press upon him that the public is demanding another adventure.
Yes, so am I. And what about you, Reese? When am I getting the next one? I saw it on the net. I saw it on Facebook. I get in trouble a lot because if I see any one of you say something about a book, or Matt Quayle or RG, he gets me in more trouble than any. And I didn't realize that his book, A Silent Victim, written by Dana Perry, is really RG Belsky. And he said it's okay to say that. And that came in the mail yesterday. I go, I can't put it down. Oh, my God, I really can't put it down. And it's at the top of the pile of whatever. So, Reese, when do I get? When are you your next book coming out? And when do I?
Well,
it's
called Dark Tomorrow. It's book 2 in the Lisa Tanchik series.
I love
my FBI special agent who investigates cyber crimes, and it'll be out on May 12th from Thomas and Mercer. And no opioids in this one, but a lot of cyber warfare.
Well, then you have to email me when you want to do your interview, because I've got somebody by the name of John Land on May 25th, and I've got R.G. Belsky on May 26th, John, and May 5th I have R.G. Belsky, so I'm getting very popular. It's really amazing. And
well,
I
hope
even,
you can fit me in. I'd love to come back.
Yes, I'll fit you in. Don't worry. I'll get there. But I want to thank everyone. This has been really eye-opening. I had, like I said, I had my own reasons for wanting to do this, and I'm going to do some more. Cigarette smoking bothers me. Vaping bothers me a lot, too. But there are other issues that are in the news that we see every day that bother me equally as much. But this really is, because the minute you go to the doctor, the minute you have surgery, they would you like this? It's almost like a menu of, instead of a menu of food, it's a menu of drugs. But I want to thank everybody for coming on the show today. This has been fun, fantastic. What a way to end 2019 with a phenomenal show like this. Thank you, everyone. Have a great day, and bye.